Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop here in lovely Exton, Pennsylvania. Thanks, as always, for patronizing the shop and for listening to this. And you'll find out later what you do is part of what I've always wanted out of life. Not just listening to me, but enjoying learning and enjoying books and enjoying coming to the bookshop. So our guest today is Valerie Tiberius, author of What Do You Want Out of Life, which is published by the Princeton University Press and released just a few days ago on January 10th. She's also the author of Well-Being as Value Fulfillment. Her other books include The Reflective Life, Deliberation About the Good and Moral Psychology, and the second edition is being published this month as well. She is a philosopher and the Paul W. Frenzel Chair in Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota. So, what do you want out of life? Well, frankly, at 70, since I've lived most of it, I mean, as a bottle of wine, I have, you know, a 2 ounce pour left. As a clock, I'm at 11:30, and as an hourglass, the Wicked Witch of the West is walking into my garret with her flying monkeys. So I'm in a little different position than you youngsters. So what did I want out of life? I wanted a great father and mother. I wanted 2 wonderful brothers, 3 incredible wives. I guess there's a rub there. 4 incredible children, 5 amazing grandchildren, a career, 2 careers, 3 careers. Money, I guess so. Health, probably most important, and which I have. And lots of other things. And I think I've gotten all of the above, which I suppose raises kind of a regressive and perhaps tautological worldview, because did I know I wanted them before I got them? But you guys are still struggling at time over careers, relationships, wealth, kids, maybe just overwhelmed, even worried about weight and food. And Valerie asks us, how do we think through these choices, goals, values in the face of what always has been continual change. So she advises us that you and I can see more clearly by looking within, creating, imagining a future that takes the form of some kind of ideal. And as Socrates may have said, the unexamined life is not worth living, which I have some trouble with, by the way. So what do we value, hold dear, and why? And do we even know? So the answer isn't 42, but both Douglas Adams and Monty Python may very well have something to say about all this. So I'll tell you one thing that I'm certain about, although Valerie differs. I've never had to make a choice between ginger and pumpkin cheesecake, because why would anyone in their right mind eat flavored cheesecake? The only cheesecake to eat is regular, good old New York cheesecake. And that has been something that I've wanted to get out of life. And now, as I was saying to Valerie, because of my intermittent diet, I haven't been able to. So as my listeners know, I'm beginning to ramble. So with that, thanks so much for joining us today, Valerie.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
So, well, first, with the last name of Tiberius, that has to have affected your life, and people must talk to you all the time about the fact that, you know, this guy who had a brilliant military career, he and his younger brother, Drusus, helped carry out the expansion of the Roman Empire along the Blue Danube and into modern day Germany. But he was almost universally disliked. So how has that affected you? Because people must comment on it, obviously.
They do. There was a point when I was in college, the main comment was, did you know that Captain James T. Kirk's middle name is Tiberius? That was the connection, especially at video stores. Now, your younger listeners won't remember Blockbuster, but when I would rent videos, that was invariably the comment, as if no one had heard of the Emperor. And people do ask me about the name, but I think the average person is not quite as informed about Roman military history as you are.
Well, one of the things that caught my eye initially as I was researching was, and we spoke before about it, and I spoke about it in my introduction, your family on your website, they seem so lovely and talented. So can you say philosophically that they are something you wanted out of life because they're there whether you chose them or not? So unless we live in some kind of solipsistic world in which I or you are not here anyway, how does that work? I got confused.
That's an interesting question. So I guess the way I think about it is that, you know, well, as the saying goes, you can't choose your family, and you just alluded to that. So you grow up with a family, and because of that, you turn into an adult who values relationships with other people. If your family has been decent to you and has treated you with some respect and love and caring and attention, you're likely to value that family that you have, those relationships with your parents and your siblings, like it sounds like you do, and I do as well. And, you know, we're very fortunate. There's certainly people who grow up with families that are not respectful and kind and who reject them because of choices they've made. And I think people like that end up valuing family in the abstract, but they don't, the particular people that they have in their family aren't doing the job. And so you find people who have chosen families, that's a phrase you hear these days too, where they're trying to fulfill that, the value of family, but with people who are not the people they're biologically related to. So I don't think the specific people in our lives are our goals. They, once we get to know them, we value our relationships with them, but we don't start out like, I want to have a good mom, better get born into this household, right?
Yeah, one of the things that made me think of something, one of the things you do in the beginning of the book, and I felt the same way, is you kind of allude to the fact that other people aren't as lucky, bad word, privileged as you and I are, so that we can worry about the smaller things like shoes. So if, you know, a tenth of the world is starving, 25% of the world is at war, you know, there's at least 2% that are refugees. Those people, one, don't have the opportunity to read this book. And if they did, if every day they're searching for food for their family and basically survival, how do you equate that with what you and I have to worry about?
Yeah, I think not very easily. So, you know, there's a way in which I think this book is for people of relative privilege or good fortune, let's say.
Good fortune, that's good.
And, you know, I kind of grappled with that because it bothers me. Like, you don't want to be just writing for the worried well and for people and just people who are just like me. So I think two things about it. First, I think it's not true that the ideas from my book are useful only for like really wealthy people. I mean, I'm not really wealthy. I don't know about you, but
anybody, you never get wealthy by owning a bookstore.
That's a good point. Yes, I should have put two and two together there. But anybody who has enough of their needs met to be able to have some leisure time, and who's enough away from a state of desperation that they really can genuinely make choices about how their life goes, I think these ideas are useful for anyone in that category. And then the other way I think about that question is, you know, I think it's important for those of us who are very lucky and who have been fortunate in life to think about the wisdom of valuing helping other people to some extent. So I don't necessarily, you know, I don't think we should all go join the war in Ukraine or become soldiers or work for nonprofits. But I do think that we should all, morally speaking, do our part to make the world a better place. And that means helping some of the people who are not fortunate to come up to a level where they do have the freedom to make the kinds of choices that the rest of us are able to make.
That reminds me of something I've been interested in lately because of someone I know who's adopted the precursor of this philosophical school. So I was thinking about utility and utilitarianism, and David Hume and Jeremy Bentham and then John Stuart Mill. And I was thinking of the idea of life is basically to derive the greatest pleasure that you can out of your own existence. And then as it morphed down to Mill, he kind of said, yeah, well, that means also taking care of everybody else too, but not Hume. So that's, oh yeah. So, okay. Couple that with the fact that you are a philosopher. In the beginning of the book, you kind of say, you know, I don't really like this, some of the new philosophy because I get caught up in the details of it. And so we're talking about philosophy, and that's one philosophy. So one, what do you think about that? And how did you approach the book initially as a philosopher? Two completely different questions.
Right. So on the utilitarianism front, I'm just teaching this right now in my ethics class. And I love John Stuart Mill. I think, you know, he was a cool guy and a social reformer and an advocate for women's rights. What's not to like about him? I think what that, you know, what Mill thought about, so utilitarianism is the view that what we ought to do is whatever maximizes the total happiness for everybody concerned. And Mill thought that most of us just aren't that important in life to be able to make huge differences. So we should just probably concern ourselves with our inner circle, our friends and family. But utilitarians these days, because of, you know, we're in a global village, these days utilitarians, many of them think like effective altruists and the ethical futurists, they think we should concern ourselves much, 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 much more with the global population and even future generations of people. And I guess I'm not, like, there's some ideas in utilitarianism that I think are really extremely important that I like, but I'm not a card-carrying utilitarian. So I don't tend to think that that's morally demanded of us to do quite that much. I think we need to do our fair share, but not, we don't need to sacrifice ourselves completely. So your second question, how did I think about this book as a philosopher? I mean, I think, you know, one thing I did was worry about why it's philosophy, because that's a thing philosophers do. We're always somehow policing the boundaries of our field. Is this really philosophy? Is this not philosophy? And then at some point I just thought, who cares? It's things I know about and have studied, and that's, I'm a philosopher, so that's good enough.
It's one of the reasons I raised the utility concept. I just interviewed last week. That's what I wasn't looking away. I was reading this. I interviewed this guy who wrote on John Stuart Mill, Philip Kitcher. The book just came out. Yeah. So that's, I think that might be an interesting book for you to use in your courses. But
I know Philip, he's wonderful.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sure.
Had a good conversation.
He was such a nice guy too.
Yeah.
It's such a pleasure to talk to him. So I was thinking about your title, because titles are really important to a bookseller, titles and covers. And because I've said this in many interviews, but, you know, people say you can't judge a book by its cover, but pretty much everybody who comes into my bookstore does. And it's a great cover. But so I was thinking of the title. So you could look at it two ways. What do you want out of life? That is, you have a life and basically it's this container. But if you say, what do you want out of life? It almost sounds like you're squeezing a tube of toothpaste. You know, what do you want out of life? You could say, what do you want in life? So there's two ways I thought of it. I thought, okay, you're given this life. You're swimming in this black sea. You pop up for 70 or 80 years. You look around, then you go back down. So, and what do you want to do during that time period? But when you think about what do you want out of life, it's like, it's a strange phrase.
Huh, that's You know what? You're making me think. I wish I had thought of what do you want in life? That's nice. I like that. Nobody came up with that. Where were you when we were titling the book? So, you know, I am terrible at titles. I always outsource it. And in fact, I think it was my mom who thought of this title, or she thought of a version of it. Because my titles were always the kind of titles you could never sell. They were things like, you know, values, choices, and conflict between goals, and, you know, these three word titles, and they were just boring. And I like to think the book isn't boring. So the title didn't do anything to help the book. So I got all these ideas from other people. My mom thought of something that was pretty close to to the current title. And then I ran it by my editor, Rob. And he was really good about thinking of things in a pithy way. So that's how the title came to be. So which is to say, I don't have any. I you're quite right that out of is a funny phrase. But it was a little bit happenstance that it came to be the phrase in the title.
The reason why publishers approve of titles is because they need to sell books. And that's why they like covers and maybe let you vet covers. But the reason I like the title is because everybody I interview has a subtitle. And your previous works have subtitles too. But I find that people like books that, you know, have one title and then don't need to put a subtitle afterwards in order to give the reader a further idea of what the book is about. So I just like that kind of phrasing.
I'm wondering if I should not tell you that the book does actually have a subtitle.
Oh, I forgot. Oh, because I only had the galley. I don't have the finished copy.
I have to tell you, I was pleased that you didn't read it because I thought, oh, it sounds better without the subtitle.
I'm sorry.
So the subtitle is A Philosophical Guide to Figuring Out What Matters. But yeah, on the cover, it's very small.
Yeah, when I get the galley, it usually just says it at the top. And what it says at the top is the shortened version because it can't fit across that galley page. But the other thing that was struck me at the very beginning, because, you know, you wrote this during COVID and a lot of authors talk about that when I interview them. But you were also worried about, I'll say it, Trump, democracy. But that was back then. Now, look how much worse it is. Look at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists earlier this week. They moved the doomsday clock from 100 seconds to 90 seconds. You know, it's in seconds now instead of minutes. So that has to impact, well, it certainly impacted me when I think about, okay, well, what is what I want out of life, assuming we're still here? And you were worried about it then. I think it's worse now in a very short period of time.
Yeah, in some ways it's worse now because of the war.
Right.
The big war, I mean.
Yeah, right. But also because of, that's the other thing. We don't really have civil discourse in this country anymore, which impinges on the subject matter of your book as well. At least I don't think we have it.
I agree. I keep thinking there's going to be a moment where things turn and I thought it might be this, oh dear, I always forget his name, the congressman who was elected who lies about everything, George.
Oh, yeah, because his name really isn't his name anyway, apparently. Well,
yes, exactly. I sort of thought that might be the moment where people woke up and thought, okay, we've gone too far. But I've thought that at, you know, 25 different moments, that this will be the moment. I thought January 6th would be that moment. It wasn't.
Well, now, you know, I and my friend Mike, since 2015, have been saying, you couldn't make this stuff up. And now I can't say that anymore because it's like satirizing satire, you know?
Yeah, it's probably a hard time to be a political satirist.
Yeah.
Do you know The Onion?
Oh, yeah, I love The Onion, yes.
Newspaper. Yeah, I mean, these days, the actual headlines are sometimes as funny as The Onion headlines, which is...
Yeah, when Trump did his NTFs, not NFTs, on Saturday Night Live, all they did was use his words and his pictures. There's really nothing else you can do because you can't make it funnier than it was.
Yeah.
But as usual, we're trying to sell your book, and then I go off on these weird ass.
That's kind of fun for an author, though, who might be, you know, tired of her own ideas and enjoying. But I will say about the pandemic that, I mean, one thing I think it did for people who weren't suffering tremendously from it, you know, so I have a friend who's a cardiologist, and she was working constantly under really risky conditions with abusive patients who didn't want to wear their masks. So like those kind of people had a different experience, but for people who were sort of isolated and bored, like many of us, it did kind of force this moment of thinking about what really matters. And I think that's partly why you see these trends of people quitting their jobs, or the quiet quitting, people who are like reining in their jobs so that they're just not willing to work 24/7 anymore. And I think the pandemic it was this moment where we could all kind of see like, oh, the way that I've been living my life doesn't match what actually matters in life. I don't know. Did you have that experience in the pandemic?
Well, I kind of hate to say this, and I don't feel guilty or proud about it. And I do feel strongly about some woman in the inner city that is a single mother who had two jobs, three kids to raise. I can't even imagine what that must have been like. But for me, COVID was one of the nicest times of my life, because I was at home with in our bubble, if you will, with my family, my children. My house was surrounded by woods and streams. So what did we do every day? We walked in the woods and streams. And it's like, what could be better than this? And, you know, it sounds horrible because, again, it goes to our positions of relative privilege or whatever. But for me, it was wonderful for 2 years. And like I said, I don't feel bad. I mean, I don't feel bad about saying that, but it's kind of like what you were saying, only a little bit more extreme.
Yeah. I mean, that is a way of being impressed by what matters in life, because you have this moment where what you're doing is walking in the woods and spending time with your family, and you realize how happy you are. And it makes you think, well, all that other crap that, I mean, maybe you're an extremely well-adjusted person who never sweats the small stuff. But, you know, I think for a lot of us, the sort of busy work and stuff that occupies our to-do lists, like a lot of that, there was less of that for people like you and me. And right. and we could have this moment where it was like, oh, this is what it's like to live when you only are doing a few things that are important to you. It was so hard for, I mean, anyone who had little children, it was just so, so hard for my friends with little kids. And yeah, children matter to parents, and people want to be good parents. So that was a place where people's values were really frustrated by the pandemic.
My granddaughter, Skylar, is 2 years old today, and she was born just as it started. So for 2 years, she was totally socially distanced. Who knows? She didn't have any physical interaction, emotional, mental interaction with other people. So who knows what that will do? And you talk about stuff like that, you talk about how you grew up as being a people pleaser. And I wondered about, one, whether you still are, or you find yourself being one, or how that helped or hindered your growth and your decision to become a philosopher.
Yeah, it is still there. I was a department chair for 6 years, which is an administrative position where you're kind of the manager of your academic unit. That drove some of it out of me, because you couldn't really be too much of a pleaser and be department chair. But it's still, you know, it's one of those things I talk about in the book, that there's some parts of our personalities that are just really sticky, and even no matter how much you might want to train yourself out of it or get rid of it, you might just have to learn to live with it. And for me, being a people pleaser is a bit like that. I'll never be fully rid of it, but I can kind of, you know, make it be a quieter part of my personality. I think, you know, in terms of being a philosopher, having a pleaser personality was just a sheer conflict. There was nothing good about that part of my personality professionally. It did not serve me, I don't think. I mean, maybe in interviews it did, because I'm, you know, I'm personable. I can make people comfortable at a dinner table, and maybe people like that. But philosophers, they want, you know, well, at least when I was coming up in the world of philosophy, they're looking for a sort of sharp, biting intellect and a kind of aggressiveness in conversation. So I think some philosophers thought I must not be too bright if I was so sociable and friendly at the dinner table.
Yeah, you talk a little bit about that in your preface as well. Well, so I interviewed this woman, I think her name was Susan Cain. She wrote this book called Quiet, which is a good title. And it was about introverts. And she talked about the extroverted introvert. And what I thought, because I've been in business and in negotiation, and she said introverts do better in negotiation than anybody else because they listen and they learn more than anybody else in the room. And I thought, you know what? That's 100% true. So she talked about the advantages of being an introvert.
That's really interesting. I think being a pleaser is not the same as being an
extrovert. No.
Yeah, because I guess I would say I'm a little bit extroverted, but not highly extroverted. Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad because I think it's hard to be introverted. So it's good that they have an edge.
What about like, I was thinking of François Villon. You know, he's this great poet, but he was also a murderer and a thief. And, you know, did his poetry redeem him? And was his, I thought about a bunch of people, including like Adolf Hitler. Yeah, okay, here's this guy. What did he want out of life? Apparently, up until the end, he got what he wanted. And you talk a little bit about, you know, basically do good things happen to bad people? And I wondered about those people whose goal is to, you know, have a Lamborghini, go to the Met Gala, fly their private plane, and this is what they wanted and this is what they got. Are you condemning them? I mean, I kind of do. I mean, and that might be wrong too. What about those people?
Yeah. So my view about how to live your own life well is kind of on the subjective side of things. So I don't feel like I have a leg to stand on to condemn those people, unless there's something in them that's, you know, that they're missing. And sometimes people who devote themselves to wealth and fame and get wealth and fame end up feeling empty and, you know, purposeless and depressed. I was watching this. I just started watching this show with Maya Rudolph called Loot, where she inherits, or not inherits. She in her divorce settlement, she gets like $87 billion and becomes the third richest woman on the planet. And so she has absolutely everything, but she's just partying and drinking all the time and totally lost, and her life feels pointless to her. So there are people like that. And, you know, I can, the views that I develop allow me to say, well, that's not good. But I think it's just true that there are some people who have values that the rest of us think are shallow and superficial, and they succeed in those values and they're really lucky. And then their lives are fine from there, given the kind of people they are. I do think we can condemn them morally if you're into condemning people. So, so, you know, morality gives you a different perspective to come at this. I don't think we can say, oh, you have a bad life for you, but we can say, you know, people who live lives like that are morally wanting. They're not contributing to the project of lifting up other human beings or eliminating injustice or solving climate change or whatever the great moral challenges are of our time, they're not contributing to that. And so I think we can make moral judgments about them, which isn't really not so much what my book's about, but it comes in a bit at the end.
You know, I love David Foster Wallace and his father. And this goes to your ethics class. His father wrote this book, James Wallace, and it's called Ethical Norms.
I didn't know his dad was a writer.
And his mom is too. His mom was a grammarian. She was like, and he would always ask her when he was writing, you know, is this right? Should this be a participle here? Should I end it with a preposition? Is that okay? And she would write him back these really humorous responses. But like, I don't even understand what ethical norms are. I figure as long as you're here, I might as well ask you these questions.
That's true. Did you ask Philip Kitcher?
Yeah, I kind of did. Not in so many words. But yeah, I was trying to think, is there some kind of standard deviation? Is there a reversion to the mean? Because he goes, ethical norms, particular cases. So it sounds like to a layman, ethical norms, okay, this is where we should be, as opposed to up here or down here. But I don't think that's right at all.
Yeah, so like one question is, how do you define what an ethical norm is as opposed to some other kind of norm, like a norm for beauty or whatever? And then the other question is, well, if that's what a norm is, what are they? So there are different ways of thinking about what ethical norms are, but for philosophers, they definitely don't mean, as you were thinking, it doesn't mean the average of something. It doesn't mean the statistically normal. It doesn't mean like what people tend to do, nothing like that. What it means is how we ought to be. So the ethical norms from philosophy speak would be the correct norms, the ones that ought to guide our moral conduct. And different philosophers think about these things in different ways. Like utilitarians, there's only one ethical norm, and it is do whatever produces the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That's it. I tend to think about ethical norms in kind of contractual terms. So, you know, I think morality evolved to help us live together and cooperate and coordinate, get the benefits of cooperating for everybody. And so I tend to think ethical norms are the ones that we would all agree to if we were having a reasonable conversation about it. So they're norms against lying to each other when there's something at stake, norms against breaking promises, norms against stealing each other's stuff, norms against killing each other. Those all come from the need to live together as a group.
It makes me feel even worse about today's society. Crap.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I've stopped not so much writing about morality, and I'm just writing about individual flourishing instead.
You know, getting back to selling the book, in one way of presenting it to, which I will, to my clients, my customers, my patrons, and, you know, our book clubs too, because we have a nonfiction book club, is, I'll use the term, if someone looks at this as a self-help book, which it kind of is, I guess the best way to get back to the book rather than me going this way and that is to talk about the value and goal thing that you do, which is you have five different things, you know, introspection, lab rat strategy. Why don't we go through those? We can go through each of those five briefly. So they are introspection, lab rat strategy, guided reflection, learning from others, and exploration. And you can either explore those one by one or just do the whole gestalt thing.
The gestalt thing. Yeah, maybe I'll try to gestalt it a little bit. So I think people think that we tend to think I know what I value. And if you ask people on a survey what their values are, they have an answer. And I think people kind of know what they value. Like you said some things in your introduction about valuing your family and your health and stuff like that. So I think what we don't know about ourselves is what those values mean, like what our standards are for success in terms of those values, how they like the interpretation and how they are prioritized with respect to each other. And those things, so those are the things we have to find out about ourselves. And the kind of most obvious strategy is to just think, well, what, you know, I value family. Okay, what does that mean to me? I think that's a good starting place, but it's kind of a limited strategy because there's a lot of our thinking that's and our feelings that are subconscious and not accessible to introspection. So we need other strategies, and those other strategies, I mean, they all have something in common. The idea is to try to get out of your own rational head, your sort of linguistic thinking brain, and try to see yourself as an animal, as a creature who's trying to get things in life. And how is that creature reacting to the world? And you can try to do that on yourself. That's what I call the lab rat strategy, to sort of try to picture yourself as if you were your dog or your friend, and you're looking from the outside and thinking, how's life going for this creature? Or you can actually like ask your friends and family or get feedback from other people, including therapists, about how things are going. So that, I think that's the most important, you know, through line of those strategies. And then I end with exploration, because I think like you want to avoid a kind of self, a solipsistic navel gazing, where you're just like, well, what do I care about? Let's think about me. And if that's all you do, you could miss lots of things that you would love, but you're too busy thinking about yourself and reflecting on your own life to explore those things. So I think to find out what really matters to us and how it matters, we also need to try things and, experience new activities, explore the world. I mean, it doesn't have to be the whole world, but explore different things.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too in your book. I was thinking about what I do when I go to sleep at night. For some reason, I've started crossing my arms, but it makes it seem like I'm in a coffin. I don't know why I do that, but I never did that before. This is where I start rambling. But anyway, so what I do is I just lay there and like I try to get rid of all thought and just see where I go, not necessarily in the Buddhist fashion, but it's just the moment and just see where it goes. Try not to go to the real world. And so I was thinking about that. And then I was thinking, wait a minute, why do I have to want anything out of life? Like I was saying during COVID. Oh, you know what it's like? It's like that movie, The Last Samurai, with Tom Cruise and whoever it was, I've forgotten his name. But like he's dying, and all his life he's been looking for the perfect rose petal. So not rose, what is it? Cherry blossom. So as he's dying and he's looking at the cherry tree, he always wanted to find the perfect one. His last words were, they are all perfect. And so I thought about that. What about the people who, for want of a better word, are enlightened and live in the moment? So
yeah, I thought about this too. I think that's a really important thing. So one thing I want to say is this strategy you have before you go to sleep, that's really cool, because that's the kind of strategy of reflection that some like personal coaches would recommend, where you're essentially trying to turn off your rationalizer and see what comes up, you know? And so that's a neat thing to do. So here's the way I think about it, and you can tell me if this sounds right to you. One of my main goals in life actually is to be a less anxious person who's more in the moment. And you know, the goal is to be, essentially my goal is to be less goal focused. So it's a little bit paradoxical, but I do think it actually makes sense to think of it that way, because if you live in our culture and you are fairly goal focused in terms of the goals that are, you know, sanctioned by our culture, you can't just be more mindful. You have to do something to get there. You have to train yourself. You have to read books about it or listen to meditation tapes or adopt strategies or something. So I think it actually does make sense of it to think, sorry, it does make sense to think of being more serene, being more mindful as a value that you can have a plan to pursue. Once, if you can actually achieve it, then it's a value that's, that isn't like part of it. It's not part of a type A personality. It's a different kind of value, but I still think it is a state of mind that you value being in. What do you think of that?
Makes me think about, and I don't have it in front of me, the Monty Python quote that you use in your book.
Yeah, I can't remember it verbatim either, but what is the meaning of life? It's something like...
Yeah, you use the movie and it's basically, you know, take care of yourself, blah, 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 try to do good things for other people. And I was thinking about that because you also mentioned Maslow and the basic hierarchy of needs. So I was thinking of the top one, self-actualization, which is what we're talking about, going to sleep and just before you go to sleep. But talk about, well, and then the bottom one, maybe not the very bottom, is Millicent, your turtle. Talk about your turtle.
Can I just say about Monty Python, did you notice that part of the meaning of life is to read a good book?
Yes. a good book now and then.
Yes. So Millicent is my mother's favorite part of the whole book. And she bought this ceramic turtle at an art gallery and named it Millicent after the turtle in my book, which I think is very cute. But the point of Millicent is just to think about a goal-seeking creature who's very simple, because sometimes I think if you try to think about the sort of mechanics of goals and goal conflicts, and you think about the human case where it's so incredibly complicated because we have so many different goals and so many layers of higher order goals and sub goals and plans and choices. And whereas for me, Millicent, in the case that I mentioned in the book, she just has two choices. She can cross the street to get the strawberries or stay where she is in safety by the stream. And, you know, she can't do both of those things. And it's helpful to her to, so that kind of conflict, I think, is central to life. You have goals that are both important to you, safety and the good of food for her. And you have to figure out some way of resolving the conflict. Sometimes it might be that your goals can be redefined in some way to reduce the conflict. So like, you know, maybe Millicent wants strawberries, but maybe there are blueberries on her side of the road and she could have that instead of the strawberries. Millicent is like in philosophy, we'd say a toy example, just used to simplify things down to the very basic structure of goal conflict.
Man, that makes me think of a lot of different questions, and I'll forget three of them because I am 70 years old. First, I thought, well, do turtles really like strawberries?
I had that thought too, which is why I have a little bracket in there that says, you know, nothing hangs on the actual reality of turtles here.
Yeah, and then I thought, okay, I thought because you said it. So you, because of the book and because of this specific incident, you made your mother happy and you made her laugh. And then you made her do something. You didn't make her. I do that too. You didn't make her do anything, but she did those things. And then I think the last year of my mother's life, when she was slowing down and then she died a beautiful death, I made her laugh and sing every day. Well, I didn't make her, but we laughed and sang every day. And I thought, okay, that's pretty much all I want out of life. Because even at the bookstore, everyone who comes into my store, especially kids, they're happy because they're in a nice bookstore. And it really is a nice bookstore. And I give them things. Some kid came in and wanted to buy War and Peace. And I thought, how can I sell him War and Peace? So I gave it to him. because obviously, and again, I have the luxury to do that, but you can't make him pay for that. He's 12 years old and wants to read War and Peace. And I give them little things like rings or the best eraser in the world or pencils. And then I thought about it. I mean, okay, what could you do better in life? What better could you get out of life than make people happy and make them laugh? Right?
Yeah. I mean, your life sounds perfect.
Definitely not perfect.
No, it does sound awfully good though. Like it's what people in my age group, you know, I'm in my 50s. It's sort of it's what we hope that we'll be like in our 70s. I mean, sort of figured some stuff out and feeling like we spent our time in a worthwhile way. So I think in a way, so think about a different bookstore owner who might be a little bit more.
Gotcha.
Did Bezos ever own a bookstore or did he go? No. Okay. But think of somebody like that who starts with a bookstore and then his main goal in life is making a ton of money. He likely wouldn't give War and Peace away to 12-year-olds. Likely wouldn't be giving kids little gifts, and because he wouldn't be focused on happiness and making people happy. And you know, if he's successful and makes a ton of money, maybe he'll be reasonably contented with his life, but I don't know if he would have the kind of fulfillment that you have, where what you've spent your time doing is something that is so obviously meaningful. Like, as you said, you know, making people happy, making your mom sing, I'm using that making language too, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You said it, what else could be good in life? That's one of the reasons I think, you know, when you asked about people who just want to have a Lamborghini and make, you know, get invited to the Met Gala and don't care about other people, can they live good lives? Well, you know, some of them probably can. People are weird. People are different from each other. But I think for a lot of us, doing things that are helpful to others is the clearest path to having a life in which you can think, I lived these values and it was good.
Yeah. Sometimes I crystallize it in the idea that when they come in, I want them to feel like it's Christmas. And the other thing is, it's also play for me. And you talk about play. And philosophers, I think, have different definitions of play. And that's another puzzler for me because it's kind of muddy in my head. I mean, if you, like my dad, he enjoyed going to, yeah, he says, if you get up and you want to go to work, you have a pretty good life. That was one of the things, many things he said. He says, just don't become a toll booth collector or a shoe salesman.
What did your dad do?
He was a builder and a frustrated, he wanted to be a lawyer. So he forced me to becoming a lawyer, which I didn't really want to be. I wanted to be a writer. But if you enjoy getting up and going to work, he didn't like staying home with us. Is that play? What does that become? What does that become if you really want to get up and go to work because you get into your car, you want to rush to your job to start working, but it's not labor. What is it? What is that play?
That's a great question. My philosophers don't talk much about play. There might be some who do, but in my experience, so when I became department chair, I got a coach because I thought it's going to be hard and stressful and I'm going to need somebody to help. And that's the first thing she talked to me about was, what do I do for play? And I was, you know, I just had no idea what she was talking about. And what she said, her definition was something you do for its own sake, it's not for your health, it's not for your job. So she ruled out work as play. And your point is that if you think about play as, rather than as a type of activity, if you think about it as like whatever you do that gets you into that flow state, you know, whatever you do where you lose track of time and you just feel a feeling of joy from doing it, in that sense, anything could be play. I think you're right. But maybe she is also right that it's good to do some things in life that have no point.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, at one of the results of writing this book and talking to some, I've done quite a few interviews at this point, and there was some conversation I had with a psychologist, actually, who got me talking about, like, what did I learn from writing my own book? So I started taking tap dancing classes. And I'm terrible at it. I can barely stay upright. And it's completely pointless. I'm never going to be a great tap dancer. There's something pretty interesting and fun about doing something like that.
My mom made me take tap dancing when I was a kid. And I can still I can still remember the one dance. I could do it right now. You wouldn't want to see me, but I could do it. And I kept my tap shoes for like 50 years. And something happened to them and they're gone. And I really wanted to have them. Yeah. I love tap shoes. They're so cool.
They are cool. Wow, I'm really impressed. How long did you keep doing it as an adult?
Until I could stop. It was like giving me someone piano lessons when they hate the idea of piano lessons, which I think when your kid does that, let him stop taking piano lessons. But
so you did not enjoy the tap dancing at the time?
I went took it with my brother. No, I don't know. It's so funny because the guy who taught us tap dancing, his brother is the director of the cemetery where my father and mother are buried.
Wow.
But I am definitely not selling your book now. We got to get back to it. I don't, people either love or hate me. I would be somewhere on that. I don't know. But okay, back to your book. Okay, so you talk about existentialism for a little bit. And of course, immediately, my knee-jerk response was Sartre and Camus. And then I thought of like the book Nausea. And I thought at the end, how like he's just overwhelmed by like this tree because there's just so much stuff. There's just so much coming at him that it makes him nauseous. There's just too much out there. But your talk about existentialism was completely different. And can you explain that to me, what you mean by it?
You're making me want to read Nausea again, because I don't think I've read it since college. Maybe it withstands,
That and Journey to the East by Hermann Hesse.
Okay, good. It's good to get book recommendations from a bookstore owner. So I was thinking about, like, if you teach existential philosophy, which I do a little bit in my intro to ethics class. I'm not an expert in existentialism, but I know just a little enough. But their view is that there's no essential human nature. So everything that is of value in the world is of value because it's chosen by us and there are no constraints. So that's part of the existential philosophy. It doesn't make it, that part of it, I don't think makes it into all the wonderful novels and plays that they've written, but it's in their philosophical texts, that anti-essentialism. And that's, so I like the part of existentialism that says values, what's valuable in the world is valuable because we are here as valuers. So, you know, strawberries wouldn't be valuable if there weren't a Millicent to want them, and family wouldn't be valuable, friendships wouldn't be valuable if there weren't people to value them. But I disagree that we are completely free to choose anything we want. That's the part of existentialism I don't quite sign on to, because I do think there's a lot of variation among human beings. So I don't think there's a human nature that's rigid and exactly the same in every culture, but I think there's enough in common, and our, you know, evolution and our individual development is common enough that more or less every person is going to value broadly speaking, some of the same things. We're going to value relationships with other people. We're going to value having some autonomy in our lives. We're going to value being able to explore our environments. We're going to value safety and security. That's just, it's almost hardwired, which is, I don't want to say that there couldn't possibly be a person who is like a hermit on top of the mountain who really doesn't value relationships. I think that's possible. It's just those people are more rare. So that's my relationship with existentialism. It's a kind of I like this part of it, but not that part of it.
That's why the book is so good, because it makes you branch out. And I always think a book is good if after you read it, you're not done. You know, you're not.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Well, and then you get really strange offshoots, because I used the word solipsistic in my introduction. You even used the word solipsistic as we were beginning our talk. And so if it's solipsistic, neither of us know about it, and only one of us is talking, you know. And so then I was thinking about like this idea that you were talking about observation. And if we didn't observe, the thing wouldn't be there in the first place. So if there's no real external reality, or if you can go all the way back to Descartes, I mean,
yeah. Now, to be clear, I absolutely think there is an external reality. I don't think I'm living in a solipsism. I think you're there. I think those books behind you are real, though that could be a backdrop.
No, these are mine.
Yeah. But when it comes to values, I think values are not the same. My view is values are not the same as books. They're not physical things I can hold. I can't see them. They are, I guess the way I would put it is they're constructed from our responses. That's why I think there would be books if all the humans suddenly died. The books would still be there, but there wouldn't be values if there weren't any sentient creatures to do the valuing.
Well, then I guess in conclusion, since that's a foundation for what you're doing in your book, values, and you've written about values and you teach values. So if the book is designed, if you wrote it in order to help people, which you did, I think, then what would you say people ought to do after reading the book and reading it well, understanding it? What exercises, what changes, what says, okay, now I read this book, now where do I go with it?
Yeah.
Where do my readers go with it?
I think a good place to start, and you know, the new year is kind of a traditional time when we do this anyway, but I think a good place to start is actually with a kind of introspection or a sort of reflective exercise where you think about how you spend your time and whether the way that you're spending your time matches up with the things you actually think are important. And, you know, so that's the sort of basic starting point. When you were during the pandemic, your answer would have been absolutely yes, because, you know, if you value nature and health and family, that's what you were spending your time doing. But for a lot of people, that isn't how things line up. You sort of look at your time, and what you're spending your time doing is worrying about a lot of crap, checking trivial things off your to-do list, writing emails, chauffeuring kids around to lessons. And maybe you do want to do that. Maybe that is important, but it's better to kind of acknowledge, oh, okay, I don't like that, but that actually is important. So I think that reflective moment of looking at what am I doing and what do I care about, that's the place to start. And then after that, I think you, to some extent, need to try to get out of your head and not just listen to your own rationalizations and stories, but try to get underneath the chatty brain.
Well, I think you definitely have done that. And while I don't know yet where I'll shelve your book, whether in philosophy, whether in self-help, whether in simply nonfiction, but right now it's on the front table, so I don't have to worry about it.
Oh, thanks. That's awfully nice.
And so thank you so much for today. And thank you so much for writing the book. And I really enjoyed our discussion.
Thanks. So did I. It was really fun to talk to you.
Likewise. All right. Hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. I hope to visit one day.
Oh, that'd be great. I would love to have you.
Great. Take care.